and welcome to Public Sector Voices with Emily Rogers. On today's show, we have Joe Owen from Institute for Government. He's a program director and recently co-authored a report on the approach government should be taking regarding the coronavirus exit plan. Joe is somewhat of an expert on exit plans. He's currently leading the Institute's research on Whitehall's preparation for exiting the European Union. Hi, Joe. Thanks for joining us.
Hello. Thanks very much for having me.
So can you talk us through a little bit about what the Institute for Government does?
Yeah, so I guess the opaque one-line summary is we are a non-partisan think tank and charity. What that kind of means in practice is we are set up with the mission to try and make government more effective. Again, what that kind of means outside of jargon, I guess, is we don't look at policy or politics. We're not like other think tanks that say this is the policy the government of the day should be pursuing or that the opposition should be pursuing. We focus on how government works and suggestions on how to improve just the way government works, whether regardless of the political party who's in power. So looking at things like the civil service, parliament, devolution, public services and the tax system.
And I mean, to what extent do government kind of take on board what you say or what you suggest?
I'd love to say that they very carefully and do exactly the kind of thing that we suggest. No, I mean, it's a real mixed bag. I think we are quite effective. We do have very close links with government. We do a lot of work behind the scenes as well as the stuff that we publish. But I certainly wouldn't say that we are the kind of Pied Piper and they follow our tune.
Right. Okay. So how would you say your work has been impacted by the pandemic?
Well, I mean, I guess to start, like everybody else, how we work has totally changed. We are out of the office and have been for, 6 weeks or so. But in terms of our research program, I guess we've done quite a big piece of work to try and understand how our priorities and our programs shift. I guess there's kind of four buckets that stuff has fallen into. There's one which is stuff we're carrying on regardless. So a lot of our work on Brexit, looking at the stuff that needs to happen this year, is still carrying on to the same timeline, given that the government is still carrying on to the same timeline. So some of our work is unaffected. Some of our work, actually, the kind of context it's landing in changes, but the core work is still the same. So I would say our work on public services, we do a thing called performance tracker using data to tell us what we can learn about the performance of public services. And there, clearly, the whole framing about public service is going to be around coronavirus for when this comes out. But, you know, the kind of core project is still the same. There are new things that we're doing. So you mentioned, and that's the kind of third bucket, the new things, which is the piece of work on the exit strategy. And we're also doing work on changing shape and size of government. And then the final thing I'd say is there's quite a few things we're not doing that we thought we would be doing. So at the beginning of this year, things like civil service reform, with the big bust up between kind of, or at least as it played out in the press, between certain key advisors and the civil service, we're planning to a lot on that and a lot on constitutional reform. And I think those things now are still big issues we're interested in, but inevitably have been parked while the energy goes into focusing on the kind of shorter term coronavirus stuff, both within our organisation and obviously, of course, across the public sector more generally.
So things that have been kind of put on the back burner, like for obvious reasons, how do you go about picking them up again? Is it just, you know, as and when you have time, or is there going to be a new schedule put in place?
So I think, yeah, we've kind of looked a lot at how things are likely to play out over the next few months. I think the nature of our research program is that you can kind of, you can think about resource on a kind of project by project basis. And so whereas the stuff on civil service, the thing that has gone to the back burner, those were projects we were planning to kick off imminently. And I think what they've done is they've just kind of moved down the list of priorities, and we'll probably review whether or not once certain projects that are underway now are done, whether we want to bring them up or not. So it's relatively kind of straightforward in that respect. And we'll just have to see what goes on inside government.
Yeah, and this is the kicker, isn't it? Because everything's changing so quickly, and what is happening today and what's true today might not be the same next week. So it's very difficult to kind of, I guess, plan in advance.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, we kind of have the luxury of being a bit distant in a kind of think tank research organisation. So I guess the challenge for us is picking the questions that allows us to go away, spend some time thinking about something and have something valuable to say in a few weeks' time or months' time. ensuring that the world hasn't entirely changed. So, you know, exit strategy is clearly going to be one of those things that we do quite a lot of work on, because even if small decisions are made or bigger decisions are made, this process is going to be something that is around for quite a long time. So having something to say on that is really important. And then likewise, looking at all of the different ways the state is changing and trying to keep a track of that, again, is likely to be a longer run thing. Responding to the immediate is really, really difficult, not least because we don't have anywhere near the expertise we would need to expertly comment on the health side of this stuff. We're much more focused on just how government works.
Yeah, and let's talk about the report as well, because that is, the main reason I got in touch with you, really.
Yeah.
For those of you listening who don't know, the report was called Lifting the Lockdown, How to Approach a Coronavirus Exit Strategy. So, I mean, it's the question that everybody's asking, how are we going to come out of these restrictions? Obviously, the report went into that quite deeply. Can you tell us a little bit about it for everyone who's listening?
Yeah, so this was, as I said, we kind of recognised that how we lift restrictions is going to be a longer, much more complicated process than their imposition. We wanted to try and contribute to that by looking at what is the kind of process and the framework for making some of these decisions, recognising, you know, as I say, that we are not epidemiologists, we're a think tank looking at how government works. So there is a limit to what we can say about exactly what the exit strategy should be, but we wanted to try and bring our expertise to bear on kind of how you approach it. And so I would say there were a kind of a few key things that came out that I took away from the process, which was kind of drawing across people across the Institute for Government. The first is that it's going to have to be iterative. There is so much uncertainty that there can be no grand reveal of an exit plan that is nailed down. And you're inevitably going to have to try and ride different horses and just respond to evidence as it comes through about the virus, but also about what lockdown means for different parts of the country, different bits of the economy. All of this stuff is so unprecedented and new, not just the virus, but the kind of measures that have been put in place. You need to bake in ability to change and adapt as things go on. The other kind of key point I'd pull out is the government has so many competing objectives in this space. So obviously, one element of that is around bringing the virus under control and minimizing the number of fatalities. But then there's also the objectives around ensuring that illnesses from other reasons, because people are staying away from hospitals or whatever, don't spike. And also the kind of longer term economic well-being and the health implications that that has. So there's all these sorts of different objectives that were definitely not in tension in the decision to lock. Well, not definitely not, but almost certainly weren't in tension when the decision to introduce lockdown was, because of just the scale of the risk that the virus presented. But as we get the kind of virus and the disease more under control, whether that's fewer cases, better treatment, better understanding of who's got it, as that virus gets under control, there will be more of a tension with the other objectives. And the government's going to have to walk a tightrope, basically, between a load of really knotty trade-offs. The final couple of things I would mention on the report was things that, based on our work in other areas, really came out, was just how important it is that the government delivers when it makes a policy decision. Often the kind of implementation side of things is the much less sexy, interesting, kind of glamorous bit of policy. But if you can't do it and it's not in place, then you will lose public consent, trust, and your strategy will be undermined. So I guess that's the final key point that I'd pull out.
Yeah, I suppose trust and things like that with the public right now are of like the utmost importance, because that's when everybody's leaning on government for answers. And one thing as a normal member of the public that I pulled out from the report was it was very much about how the government needs to manage expectations. Like you said, it's not going to be a big, you know, snap of the fingers one day everybody's allowed out and everything's back to normal. It's going to be a kind of a gradual thing. How big of a difference can that make?
Well, I think it makes a really big difference. I mean, have the government having consent for these measures, you know, it's not like these measures were all inside the manifesto that this government was elected on. And so having consent for your actions is really, really important, both in terms of a parliamentary sense, actually, from a legislative perspective, but also just the general public buying, which actually, you know, the lockdown has extraordinarily high public consent. People think it's a very good thing. People are nervous about it relaxing too soon. So the government has done a really, really good job there. I think one of the points that we pulled out was all of this talk around differentiating, so giving different age groups maybe different rules, or different parts of the country different rules, or different sectors of the economy different rules. The more you differentiate, the more complicated it becomes mm-hmm. to communicate what is happening. And I think we've already seen some of that over the weekend, haven't we, about the extent to which there's a blanket rule for over 70s being required to stay inside for up to 12 weeks versus it for subsections of the over 70 groups. And so you can see how it's some differentiation makes it really difficult to land these messages. And as we go through this, there is inevitably going to be some kind of differentiation, and mm-hmm. communications just could lead to non-compliance. So non-compliance, I guess, is a kind of jargony word, but what you mean is that some people who are allowed out and are allowed to do things and return to a semi-stage of normal won't, because they won't trust it, they won't believe that they should or that they could or that it's safe. And on the flip side, people who are vulnerable and who are encouraged to still stay inside or under certain measures don't, because they see others and they don't realize that they shouldn't. And therefore, the effectiveness of these measures just gets undermined.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember, I don't know if it was a week or so ago, there was a rumour about, you know, it was going to be under 30s who don't live with their parents who would be allowed out first. And I was rubbing my hands together thinking, perfect.
Yeah, here we go. But,
you know, a lot of my friends are over 30. So, I mean, the chances of those lockdowns being broken. It just makes it so much more complicated, as you said. So, a big part of the report was about the clarity that needs to come from central government so that there isn't any more confusion, which I think is just a really key point and something that is going to be a problem.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that's worth mentioning on this point is that this isn't just a set of decisions for the UK government. So if you look at all of the decisions around closing schools or pubs, restaurants, the advice telling people to stay at home and the rules saying they need to stay at home unless you have a good reason to be out, those are all decisions taken by the devolved administration. So here the UK government only acts for England. Scotland will make its decisions, Wales will make its decisions, and Northern Ireland will make its decisions. And so there is a perfectly legitimate, from the kind of devolution settlements, if you like, for the four nations of the UK and the four governments to take different decisions about when and how to lift lockdown, which could cause some of this complication and concern. That, you know, to date, they've actually been extremely well coordinated. There's been a very kind of positive relationship, it seems, but it's not necessarily true that that is guaranteed to last, and we could see some differentiation between the devolved administrations and the UK government.
Yeah, and you don't want to be the section of the UK that has the least kind of effective outcomes, do you?
Well, exactly. And so this is one of the kind of the things that bleeds into this is why would, even though you can move at different paces, will any of the four nations decide to move at a different pace? Because, I mean, there's one reason, which is that the UK government, so the economic package is all run by the UK government on a UK-wide basis. So actually, if you're Scotland or Wales or Northern Ireland, it's very difficult for you to stay in lockdown if the UK government has decided to remove the economic support. So there's a kind of need for collaboration in that way. But then, you know, as you say, your point is you don't want to be the nation that's singled out as having handled this the worst. Because if you're Nicola Sturgeon, for example, and Scotland leaves the lockdown sooner and then faces another peak, and it's been your decision, then it all lands at your door. And so there will be a kind of political reason, I think, for why some of the nations will want to work more closely together and come at this from a united approach.
Yeah, which I think arguably could be the best approach. But yeah. How much do you think is taken from the rest of the world in terms of advice and the way other people have handled it?
Yeah, this is the, you know, you were just talking about not wanting to be the part of the UK that's handled this the worst. I mean, this is something where countries across the world can be judged against one another as well. They're all dealing with the same issue at the same time. And it allows you to draw this comparison. Yeah, exactly. And I think for the UK, for all countries, trying to learn from others will be extremely important, whether it's about understanding more about the virus, also understanding the economic consequences of some of the lockdown measures, but also what works in terms of treatment and how successful differentiation is. So again, you know, there might be health reasons why it makes sense for different groups to be treated differently, but in practice, once you've done it, does it really work on the ground? You know, even can you really separate under 30s, for example, you know, like the point you were making, is it really possible to do that? And we'll get to learn from other countries. I think, you know, so far there's been one of the big interesting splits is how places like South Korea have gone for this kind of test, trace, contain strategy of using contact tracing to understand and have a kind of grip of control over the disease in a way that the Western countries haven't, largely, I think, because, you know, like South Korea, they were preparing for another SARS outbreak and they had the infrastructure in place to deal with that. Whereas all of our big pandemic planning, if you like, was largely focused around a flu. And so our kind of systems, our approach and our thinking early was coloured by that. So you can see how the levels of preparation and planning differed because of different assumptions about what would hit and when. And will we start to homogenize would be one of the interesting questions. I mean, will there be a kind of common, well, this is how countries are dealing with coronavirus, or will we see lots of different ways? Will again be one of the interesting things that we see throughout the next kind of weeks and months, I guess.
Definitely. And it's not just that, because different countries have different needs, like the culture in countries like Italy, you know, it's very common to have grandparents living in the family home. So then that has an effect on things like death rate as well. So it is difficult to compare and have everybody on the exact same page, because the reality is that we're not all on a level playing
field. Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, countries differ both in terms of kind of the healthcare provisions that are available, the systems there in order to provide healthcare, just how, you know, we were talking about devolution and the rules that are set up that allows for differentiation within the UK. Other countries are more centralized, other countries are much more federal. So, yeah, I think you're right that there is a whole host of differences that will color people's approaches. But I guess it will be very difficult for countries who are outliers to be able to, you can see how they're going to end up being compared to everybody else. Competitive league table.
Definitely. It's not a nice position to be in. I mean, Boris Johnson faces some ridiculously hard kind of decisions that I'm sure none of us are very envious of his position right now. But let's say, for argument's sake, if this was your decision and it was your job to decide how we were going to handle this exit from the lockdown, how would you tackle it?
God, that is an absolute nightmare question. I would obviously read the excellent Institute for Government report.
I think it
is worth really saying that these are extraordinary difficult choices that this government, cabinet, prime minister will have to make from a kind of balancing public health, the economy, all of, you know, making, this isn't the parliament that he was expecting to have when he won his big majority in December. And I think one of the challenges for anyone in that position will be reorienting themselves to realise that they are now the coronavirus prime minister.
And that's his legacy.
Exactly. And so what might have worked and might have been the way you wanted to run things before all of this might not work now. And so just thinking about the structures and processes in government and the way things, the way you prioritise and approach different issues will all have to change to take account of this. And I really, really don't envy it. I mean, the point I would come back to is recognising that this is going to be iterative and there can be no certain plan that is sketched out now. One of the ways I think, you know, and we've touched on it again already, is transparency around what evidence is telling you, what evidence you're being provided as a prime minister, and starting to be upfront about it. Because I think there is a high level of support for the government at the moment in terms of its actions around lockdown. And being upfront about the choices and the really difficult choices might make that easier rather than being seen as opaque and making the wrong calls.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't really matter what your political preferences are, but anybody can appreciate what a difficult decision it is to make, and that at the end of the day, it is a cabinet of humans, and, you know, that's why transparency is key. They might not know the answer today, but it might come next week. We just don't know.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the cabinet of humans point is a really interesting one, because most crises don't last months and months and months and months.
Mm-hmm.
And if you just think about the kind of crisis footing that government will inevitably be on in trying to deal with this and make these decisions and get the testing in place, et cetera, et cetera, there's a question about how sustainable that is at that pace and for how long. And that will be one of the real challenges, is as much as there will be a kind of eagerness to run this as a crisis in the way that crises are usually run, with just the high pace intensity and over a short period, there's a question about the extent to which you can maintain that and what needs to change in order to be able to maintain this level of intensity. And just questions around staffing and support, I think, is a really interesting one, because, as I say, yeah, most crises don't last this long.
I know that one of your areas of focus is Brexit. So obviously this will have had a big effect on that, and especially the timeline of it and how quickly things will progress in terms of Brexit. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so Brexit is the thing that I think people were expecting to be talking about. I mean, it was the thing that was going to probably dominate government, whether or not publicly and in the press, the preparations for the end of the transition period at the end of this year. And of course, that timeline hasn't changed. We are still moving towards all of the big changes as a result of Brexit. So we've had the kind of symbolic and the political change of having formally left the EU. And the legal change, which is really, really significant, that happened at the end of January. But all of the big practical changes around our trading relationship, what happens at the border, what it means for public bodies and institutions and the new powers the government takes on, what it's going to do with them, all of that stuff is due to change at the end of this year. And I think that the government faces a real challenge. I mean, negotiating a new relationship and implementing it and having it all up and running by New Year's Eve this year was already going to be an extraordinarily difficult challenge, just given the scale of what needed to change and what needed to be done. Doing this when government's clearly distracted by coronavirus, and kind of rightly, its attention is on the much more immediate thing. And also businesses who are all going to have to change as well. You know, whether you need customs agents now, what forms you need to fill in to trade with the continent, how all of that works. I mean, I think most companies will be wondering how they survive the next few weeks rather than what their plans are for dealing with Brexit on the 1st of January next year. And that's going to be a really big problem for government, I think, is just getting the attention onto something that, before this came along, was, I think, the late Cabinet Secretary Jeremy Hayward described it as the largest and most complex peacetime challenge the civil service has ever faced. It's not any less big as a result of coronavirus. And there is a question about the ability for government to manage to do the response to coronavirus and Brexit at the same time, I think.
We are in for some really difficult decisions in the next few weeks, and it's going to be really interesting to see what happens. So it's quite a bleak kind of time right now. I wonder if you can draw any positives or tell us some things that you found during this time that have kind of not been so doom and gloom.
So, yeah, the things I would say that have not been doom and gloom, I was actually talking about this the other day. The first is not waking up to aeroplanes and the noise of aeroplanes. We live underneath a flight path, so having birds as opposed to aeroplanes in the morning is great.
Yeah.
Going cycling out on the roads with no cars is far nicer than it usually is in London. And the fact that my whole family has had to learn how to use Zoom and the like means that I'm probably seeing them much more than I would normally over the course of a few weeks, which is nice.
That's nice. Something that you can take forward as well.
Exactly. There'll be random quizzes on Zoom evermore, I'm sure.
Brilliant. Well, thank you so much for coming on and speaking to us. It's been really interesting. So stay safe.
Thank you very much. Take care. Thanks for having me.
So that was Joe Owen from Institute for Government, a really interesting perspective. If there's anybody that you'd like to hear on the show or any questions you'd like answering, get in touch on the website or social media and we'll see what we can do. Thanks for listening. Bye.